Welcome back to the series and to the third talk by a renowned South African writer on a favourite or compelling book. Today we're privileged to have Imran Kavadia to talk about The Sacred Book of the Werewolf by Victor Pelevin, or Pelevin, we're not sure how to say it. Imran is well positioned to comment on satire. From one perspective, his most recent novel, Taxi Poetry, can be considered a satirical adaptation of several genres: the university novel, the novel about the creative mind, and the novel about fathers and sons. I recommend that book and his previous three novels to you, and they are available on the book tables. His novel, High Low In Between, won both the University of Johannesburg Prize and the Sunday Times Fiction Prize in 2010. And the other novels were all finalists or winners of other awards and honors. Various of them have been translated into German, Italian, and Hebrew, and I think other languages. In addition to being a novelist, Imran Kavadia is an associate professor in the Department of English at UCT with degrees from Yale, Cornell, and Harvard. A writer of highly regarded academic papers and monographs, he's also a prodigious reviewer of national and international fiction and some nonfiction. Has been a judge for major literary awards and is known for his pungent and strongly argued positions on a range of literary, cultural, and social issues. A collection of essays, Transformations, was published by Amusi in 2012 and includes essays on topics as diverse as Tolstoy, Lolita, J.M. Kwasi, and the Diwali case. Deeply interested in cultural debate and the role of the public intellectual, he himself has been key in coordinating the Great Texts, Big Questions lecture series run by GIFSA at Michaelis, which I encourage you to attend. Witty, lucid, and informed, Imran's commentaries are always engaging and unexpected, as I'm sure this reflection on The Sacred Book of the Werewolf will be. Please welcome Imran.
Thanks. Whenever anyone reminds me of my CV, it reminds me of the number of mistakes I've made in various places. This is Victor Pelevin, perhaps the most fashionable-looking writer in the world, born in 1962 in Moscow. Can you hear me? Okay. His father was... Move the mic up a little. They normally get very cross with you if you move the mic to some people, because they're perfectly adjusted for it. Okay, so Pelevin's father was a professor, which is never a good sign. He was a tiny, thin boy who told tall tales all the time. He first attended the Moscow Power Engineering Institute and became an electrical engineer specializing in trolley buses. He decided he didn't want to spend his life as a trolley bus engineer and attended the Maxim Gorky Literature Institute in Moscow in 1988. He worked at magazines, published in magazines on science and religion, played chess, chose a sorcerer as a teacher, sold computers. He's rumored to be a karate expert. He became famous after the 1992 publication of Oman Ra, which is one of his kind of most interesting novels. He adopted Sufism, tenets of Sufism, Buddhism, Zen philosophy, and incorporated them into his novels. He never gives interviews. His novel, Babylon, begins with a very unusual copyright notice. Any thought that occurs in the process of reading this book is subject to copyright. Unauthorized thinking of it is prohibited. Now, one of his influences, obviously Nikolai Gogol, the great Russian Gogol, the great Russian satirist, and his short story, The Overcoat. One of the kind of cliches about Russian literature is that Russian literature comes from underneath the folds of Gogol's Overcoat. So it's worth spending 20 minutes reading that short story. But also Bulgakov's Master and Margarita, which is another really beautiful piece of Russian satire written just during the Russian Revolution. In Master and Margarita, there's a sense that the Messiah is about to return. And that same sense returns in The Sacred Book of the Werewolf. The idea is the super werewolf is about to return. Right? It's a sense of sort of imminence, but also kind of redefining what does it mean for the Messiah to have returned. Right? Our president tells us that the ANC will rule until the arrival of Jesus. Right? What does it mean for Jesus to come back in that sense? And finally, one of the key elements which I'll be talking about today is that The Sacred Book of the Werewolf is written in a particularly Russian version of narrative voice, a kind of first-person voice. Boris Eichenbaum, one of the great Soviet-era critics, called it SKAZ, S-K-A-Z. But what it the technical definition is that it's a voice on the page, which sounds like it's an individual person's voice. Right? You know this from reading many novels, but it's pioneered in the Russian novel. And it's not just a storyteller's voice or a single person's voice. It has a kind of winding, circuitous, self-conscious voice. If you want to see an example for yourself, the first page of Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. It's a really good place to begin. Right? It begins, I'm a sick man, I'm a wicked man, and then the narrator sees what he's written and he crosses it out and he thinks, oh, I made a mistake, and he tells you about it. Right? So it has that quality of kind of self-involvement, self-consciousness. Okay. Slide 2. This is, The Sacred Book of the Werewolf is the love story of a werefox, a fox woman, and a werewolf. This is one of the covers, which I think is particularly good. In the time of the appearance of the super werewolf. All right, now, Ahuli is the werefox who tells the story. A-H-U-L-I. And she's a critic of the cinema. The reason she doesn't like the cinema is because she thinks the cinema peddles in stereotypes of were creatures, right? She says, people think you turn into a fox or a wolf, howl at the moon, tear someone's throat out, and all the great questions of life are instantly answered. And it's clear who you are, what you're doing in this world, where you came from, where you're going. But that's not the way it is at all. We are far more tormented by the riddles of existence than modern humans. But the cinema continues to portray us as complacent, earthbound gluttons, non-entities who are indistinguishable from each other. Cruel and squalid consumers of the blood of others. And I think you'd have to grind to a point that we're creatures, we're wolves, and we're foxes in cinema portrayed this way. In fact, despite the fact that foxes are particularly tormented by the riddles of existence, they're quite happy creatures. Right? As Ahuli says, we foxes are fortunate creatures. Now, one of the very interesting things that the novel does as a form is produce images in the heads of the readers, right? It doesn't produce them exactly, but it provokes them, right? So it doesn't generally give you pictures, but it forces you to create or complete pictures of your own, right? Pictures of how do the characters look, right? What do the scene looks like, you know, in what situation does this conversation happen? So how do we imagine a werefox? Spend some time online, and there are three different versions of a fox woman we have here. One is actually, I think, very inexpensively priced, $69.99 outfit. You can buy if you want. I can see that many of you are probably oriented towards it. But it has, you know, it's a fox, a fox woman outfit with a tail. There's an anime Japanese fox girl here. Yeah. And here, interesting, there's an actress called Megan Fox, which I thought was very talented. Okay. Now, what's particular about foxes? Right? The key part of a werefox is the werefox's tail. Right? And as Ahuli tells, you know, talks to us about herself, the werefox is a very kind of sexualized, very feminized and eroticized creature. She says our breasts are small and perfectly formed, with small dark brown nipples. At the spot where women have their most important dream factory, we have something similar in appearance. An imitative organ with a function I'll tell you about later. It doesn't serve for childbirth. And at the back, we have a tail, a fluffy, flexible, fiery red antenna. The tail can become larger or smaller. In the sleeping state, it's like a ponytail, about 10 or 15 centimeters long. But in the working state, it can reach almost a meter in length. Impressive. All right, now, this tail, right, which seems to stand erect, right? It's almost like a penis, right? But it's actually not. It seems to carry sexual ambiguity and power. Right? But what it really does is it carries imaginative force, right? So with a werefox's tail, she can hypnotize a man and make, or woman, and make him see or hear or feel what she wants him to see or hear or feel, right? In fact, a werefox is very much like a certain idea of a novelist. Right. I don't encourage people to read things allegorically, because invariably allegorical readings are the least interesting readings of a piece of literature. You know, the pigs are the Bolsheviks and the mice are the, you know, peasants and so forth. Right? But it's at least worth remembering that novelists distribute their own experiences and understandings to their characters, right? Certainly to their most convincing characters.
And so Ahuli, the werefox, has something of the novelist in her. She sort of reminds us of the kind of the way in which novelists hear things and reproduce things, almost without thinking of them. She uses the metaphor of a tennis player. Right? This, strangely, is a picture of Pete Sampras, not Sampras, who's the other guy?
Federer.
Federer, yeah. The old person's idea of a cool young person, right? Is the tennis we foxes have one serious shortcoming. If someone says something memorable to us, we almost always repeat it in conversation with other people, regardless of whether what was said was stupid or clever. Let human beings think in the course of their heroic slalom from the vagina to the grave. A fox's mind is simply a tennis racket you can use to keep the conversation bouncing from one subject to another for as long as you like. We give people back the ideas and opinions that we have borrowed from them, reflecting them from another angle, giving them a different spin, sending them into a vertical climb. For those of you who don't know it, it's also worth reading Isaiah Berlin's great essay on the fox and the hedgehog. There's two different styles of thinking, right? The hedgehog is someone who all his life, all her life, knows only one thing, right? So Wordsworth is a really good example of a hedgehog, right? He has one idea, right? Or Marx is an example of a hedgehog, right? And he keeps to that idea and burrows into the whatever hedgehogs do thing. With that, you know, he stays with that idea all his life and makes it deeper and deeper. Whereas a fox knows many different things, right? And is always kind of hopping from one thing to another. Now, whether or not Berlin's distinction holds kind of tells you something about foxes. Now, and maybe writers. How do we think about Alexander, right? Ahuli's lover, the werewolf, is called Alexander. Or in Russian, what's the Russian version of Alexander? You all know this one. Sasha, right? Okay, so now, a fox, a werefox, only appears in words, really, right? Ahuli in this novel seems to be an effect of her voice. It's quite hard to picture her, despite the images we saw earlier. So she's quite different. A werewolf, on the other hand, is much easier, right? We're all familiar with werewolves, either in reality or from movies, right? And weird picture, right? There's one in the process of changing, and there's an entirely fully fledged werewolf. Right? The werewolf is much more male than a werefox, right? Less eroticized. It's kind of a figure of power rather than sexuality or illusion the way that a werefox is. Right? Now, one question we have to ask ourselves now as responsible readers is it possible? Could a werefox and a werewolf actually fall in love as they do in the Sacred Book of the Werewolf? Well, we have one precedent, the precedent of dogs and foxes, right? Who actually can actually be very fond of each other. Right? The various versions of this love affair that I found online. But we might have to note that halfway through this novel, Alexander, Sasha, the kind of security policeman, who's also a werewolf, loses the ability to turn into a wolf anymore. Right? And he spends the last half of the novel as a kind of quite charming brown dog. Have a picture of a dog for some of my talk. Sorry, I meant to delete that. Really, we could just spend our lecture looking at pictures of charming dogs. I rather like it. I've been wanting a dog for a long time. Okay, so how do we understand what's going on in the Sacred Book of the Werewolf? And in fact, what the specifically Russian contribution to world literature is. Right? By this point, you know, most writers have read Russian literature, absorbed some of its lessons, and so forth. There's something quite specific going on that a language, a critical language in English, our imaginative language, can't get at. Right? And we know it's there. We know that there's something particularly original and strange and fascinating about the tradition of Russian novels, particularly novels. It's hard to get at what it is. Now, the man who came closest is a man called Viktor Shklovsky. He was born in 1893 and died in 1984. So he's long lived. And here, Shklovsky, I'm going to talk a little bit about Shklovsky, but here's a lovely example of what interested him so much. Right? This is one of the fairy tales that Tolstoy was really interested in involved him thinking about a man who had met a blind man and someone trying to explain to a blind man what light is. And so you could imagine yourself either as the blind man or the person trying to explain what is light. And this is the way Shklovsky described it. They're told that light is like milk. They respond, does it mean that it flows like milk? They're told that light is like snow. They respond, does that mean it is cold like snow? They're told that light is like paper. They respond, does that mean that it rustles like paper? It's really kind of, Trotsky is one of the few critics in the world who writes as beautifully or more beautifully and suggestively than the writers. So, worth reading, for that one, pretty well. What this is an example of a term that we use a lot as literary critics, but maybe we don't think about enough, which is defamiliarization. Right? Taking something that you think you know, right, and making you look at it from a strange angle. Right? So the one thing we all know is light. Right? We're surrounded by it all the time. Right? It's part of our being. Right? Something like this makes us think, perhaps for the first time, or grasp imaginatively, right, again, how strange light is. Right? How kind of difficult it is to express in words the nature of light. And something maybe about the depth of our own experiences with light. Trotsky said one of the principal things a novel does, right, is defamiliarize things. And one way to think about a novel is as a collection of devices, right, or gadgets, right, designed to produce certain effects, certain feelings, certain intellectual and emotional changes, and so forth. And it's still probably the most useful way to think about a novel from a technical perspective, right? As a reader, you think about a novel imaginatively. Your feelings are changed, moved, altered, whatever, right? I think as a critic, you try to understand how do those feelings change? You know, how are those images produced or provoked in our heads, and so forth? And Schlossky is the most useful way, I think, to think about how the novel does it. He says, here's a general picture of human life, right? He says, automization, right? So what's automization? Habit, custom, routine, right? The fact that you've seen something 1,000 times before or done it before. Automization eats away at things, at clothes, at furniture, at our wives, and at our fear of war, right? And so, in order to return sensation to our limbs, in order to make us feel objects, to make a stone feel stony, man has been given a tool of art. Okay. So, there's a kind of defamiliarization of images which happens in Sacred Book of the Werewolf. Ahuli, for example, says, and sometimes it happens just in a phrase, right, or a word or two. I remember that man, his head was like a yellow egg, and his eyes looked like two pieces of paper glued onto the egg. Right? A lovely little example of having to reimagine what someone's head looks like. And kind of the eggness of that is very fresh. Or, for example, during one of her first interludes with Sasha, the werewolf, right? He's kind of jumped on top of her and he's transforming into a werewolf. It must be terrifying. And she says, his breath was hot but fresh, like a baby's. Lovely example. I just quoted this line, but I think I probably need to quote twice. To make a stone feel stony. Right? That's what novels do. They make a stone feel stony, or werewolf's breath feel real to you. So there's a defamiliarization of images, right? There's also a defamiliarization of human behavior, and particularly of the internal thought chains that belong to the characters. I'm going to give you an example of this. During one of her, Ahuli, this werefox, works as a prostitute, and she uses her tail to kind of make men imagine that they've had all sorts of experiences with her, which they haven't. One of her first clients is a Sikh visitor to Moscow. The Sikh got up off the bed and wandered into the bathroom. When he came back, he lay back down, lit up a cigarette, and began speaking in a relaxed voice, telling the pillow beside him some story out of his life, because he believes that she's lying. Right. After coitus, men become garrulous and benevolent for about half an hour, owing to the release of dopamine into the brain as a reward for fulfilling their duty. I didn't pay much attention to what he was saying. I wanted to finish reading about how a black hole behaves when gravitational collapse reduces its diameter to a distance shorter than the event horizon. So this kind of lovely example of how actual thought chains work in human beings, right? Rather than how they're meant to work. Right? And it makes you feel again just how weird the human mind is. Right? There's also defamiliarization of logic. Right? Now, werefoxes have two principal enemies. Right? One is the aristocrats of Britain. Right? who have obviously hunted foxes for centuries. So were foxes famously insinuate themselves into aristocratic households and then after years kill their aristocrats, right? The other enemy they have are Taoists, Chinese Taoist exorcists. So suddenly, in this hotel room with the Sikh client, Ahu Lee thinks, oh my God, I'm facing a Taoist exorcist. So this was a totally absurd idea, because one, the last Taoist capable of hunting foxes lived in the 18th century. Two, even if one of them had managed to hold up until modern times, he would hardly have been able to disguise himself as a bearded Sikh with an Oxford accent. That would have been too freaking much. Three, since I work according to the method that I give back, as well as take, Taoists have no formal right to come hunting me. Four, Taoists never come three times in a row. That's crucial to remember. So if you've been visited twice by a Taoist exorcist, you know, it's fine. It won't come again. All right. For Shklovsky, the book itself is not an object of veneration. Right? He says, art is a means of experiencing the process of creativity. The artifact itself is quite unimportant. Right? This is one of the most radical statements in the history of criticism. Right? Literary criticism is devoted to making monuments of all the great works of art, right? Whether they're paintings or plays like King Lear or novels. But it's not an attitude that works very well with a novel, which is... It's been a strange kind of art form. And so I like this idea that kind of a novel is something you use up in the course of reading it. And for those of you who spend a lot of time rereading your novel, you'll know there are very few novels that survive the act of rereading. There are some, many, but I would say 1% or 2% of novels actually survive it. And I think it's partly, well, if we were to agree with Shklovsky, it's partly because novels like that contain so much great originality. Different perceptions of certain stuff. So the book is a kind of vehicle to participate in the creativity of the writer, but not in a kind of worshipping way, but rather, in the sense that we all have universal, creativity is distributed to everybody. The book just enables different people to reach it. Now, in a sense, the Russian novel's contribution is that it's the way that strangeness, originality, unexpectedness enters the form of the novel, right? In English, strangeness and originality, unexpectedness enters literature through poetry, and particularly through Shakespeare's tragedies. Right? Those are the strangest, most original experiments in our language, right? But in Russian, that strangeness enters through the novel. And in fact, historically, it's through the Russian novel that strangeness has entered and subjectivity has entered the novel as a whole. We could call it originality, we could call it improvisation. But what we could say is that in English, the novel is a commercial form. Right? Even all those Booker Prize-winning novels and Pulitzer Prize-winning novels, they're business productions. Right? And you can see that because they rely so heavily on the generic elements. And anything involved with commerce becomes generic, right? Becomes standardized. Right, so plot, scene, episode, those are the key structural features of the English novel. Right? And the way they make English novels very easy to read, very easy to market, but actually quite unsatisfying, often. And particularly in the kind of 18th and 19th centuries, right? There are some great English novels, but it's surprising how much more interesting the Russian novel is than the English novel. And how in one page a Russian novel can do things, or a short story can do things, that an English novel can hardly do over 100. Shklovsky says, look, plot-oriented prose still exists and will continue to exist, but it has been consigned to the attic. Extreme statement, but it's worth hearing anyway. And then what do we get in exchange? Now, I think Ahu Lee, the werefox in Pelevin's book, is a good example. At some point in the novel, she's generally quite a cheerful werefox, but at some point, she feels differently. She says, I had a dreary, depressed feeling so deep in my soul that I was almost ready to believe I had one. So, I want to be forever young, Altaville sang yet again on the radio. I wish I had your problems, I thought, and immediately remembered my own. Beautiful. The Russian novel introduces certain sorts of psychological facts to the novel form, right? Extreme subjectivity of feeling and perception, chains of association which you wouldn't have seen anywhere in literature except in Shakespeare, right? Double or multiple streams of perception and feeling in the same mind, right? As Ahu Lee tells us, these voices mean foxes don't think in the same way as people. The difference is that several thought processes develop in our mind instead of just one. The mind follows several different paths at the same time, keeping an eye open to see which will lead to the light of truth first. These thought processes don't intersect with each other in any way. They're absolutely autonomous, but my consciousness is involved in each one of them. If you want a clue to the kind of the vividness, or I don't know what the right noun for, vividity, what is it, vividness? The vividness of, say, Tolstoy's prose or Shakespeare's kind of psychological states, it's that they almost always have multiple overlapping streams of perception and feeling. Right? So a character simply feeling a state of happiness is kind of boring, right? But a character feeling a state of happiness and annoyance at the same time, or as Ahu Lee, describes it, right? Depression, but also listening to Alphaville on the radio. That becomes interesting and vivid, right? And so one of the keys to kind of this kind of originality is always portraying the mind as containing multiple entities, feelings, perceptions inside of it. One of the questions we have to deal with is, what do we call this kind of writing? And I mentioned the word scars to you earlier, the kind of the storytelling quality of the writing. But it's also ironic, right? The kind of novelistic prose you find in the Book of Sacred Wolf is self-conscious, ironic about itself. It calls itself a forgery on the very first page. Right? Now, the idea that the world is a forgery, that the work is a forgery, goes hand in hand with a kind of world of forged objects and repressive politics. I was thinking about, many people have made a connection between post-Soviet Russia and post-apartheid South Africa. Right? I think one of the things that joins them is that, in a sense, it's impossible to find a consistent place to stand. Right? That, right and left, political labels and organizations are less relevant than the kind of general chaos or unpredictability of things. And I think that's why it's such a kind of useful book for us. I'll give you one example of kind of the strange objects that you find in the Sacred Book of the Werewolf. And I didn't bring a photograph of this, although I found one last night of a Monica Lewinsky's cigar cutter. Ahu Lee goes into, it's not my invention, it's actually, it is a Monica cigar cutter company. Ahu Lee goes into Sasha's office and she says, standing on the desk beside the elegant all-in-one computer was a massive silver object I'd taken at first glance for a figurine. On closer inspection, the object turned out to be a cigar clipper. It was a figure of Monica Lewinsky lying on her side with one leg raised towards the ceiling to act as a lever. And when it was pressed, I couldn't resist it. Not only did the guillotine and the ring between her thighs snap into action, but a tongue of blue flame appeared out of her open mouth. It was a great little gadget. To my mind, the only superfluous touch was the American flag that Monica was holding in her hand. Sometimes just a tiny weight is enough to shift the balance and to transform a piece of erotica into kitsch agitprop. Right? Now, the question is, what place does the novel literature thinking have in a world that's filled with kitsch objects and kind of politics that's impossible to grasp or take a stand in? And I would say kind of irony is considered a kind of intellectual or aristocratic or literary virtue, right? But actually, kind of irony you see in Pelevin is a place for in which suddenly a world which doesn't make sense gives you a place to kind of feel, I don't know, somehow that the world, kind of a virtual place where the world does make sense, right? And so it's quite it's a kind of a deep fact about a country that it invites ironic literature as opposed to kind of sincere literature of the United States, right? Literary styles don't just become compelling just out of from nowhere. They become compelling because they reflect something of your everyday experience. And our everyday experience is, I think, at least invites us all to to require this kind of irony. Skrotsky also says quite beautifully that old literature inhabits new literature as if without permission. And like Anna Karenina, Tolstoy's great marriage novel, right, Lolita is the other kind of Russian novel through which all Russian novels pass. In a sense, it's a kind of discipline, training camp for Russian novels. And Ahuli is aware that she's kind of a Lolita figure. Right? She says, to look at, because she's a werewolf, she doesn't age. To look at, I could be anything from 14 to 17 years old, right? Closer to 40. My physical appearance arouses feelings in people, especially men, that are boring to describe, and there's no need. Nowadays, everybody's read Lolita, even the Lolitas. And, you know, at various points she quotes Nabokov, and is very interested in Nabokov, his poetry and his points of view. The other thing that, you know, we could say in virtue of the Russian novel is that the senses in the Russian novel are more alive and thrilling and unexpected than the senses in any other novel. And, you know, I've had thousands of examples. I'm not even sure what the right one to use would be. At some point, Ahuli tells us that was the kind of people that used to be in Russia. Although, in fact, I suspected that he didn't write the poem himself, but commissioned it from his friend, the gay poet Mikhail Kuzmin, since after the revolution, I was visited by a gang of cocaine-intoxicated queers from the Cheka, looking for some diamonds or other. Right? The homophobia of the sentence exempted. It's kind of, there's no way of predicting where you're going to end up in that sentence. And that kind of freewheeling quality is also this extraordinary fact about the Russian. Okay, so just two points to end with. One is, you know, as academic staff, we're always asked, what is the social relevance of what you're doing? How does it apply to the real world? Well, let's see what Ahuli tells us about the state of post-Soviet Russia. In ancient times in the Middle Kingdom, every official strove to do good on the great way of things. But here, they all set up their own toll bars across the road and only raise them for money. And the essence of the social contract lies precisely in them raising their dooms for each other. The elite here is divided into two branches, which are called the oligarchy, derived from words oil and gold, and the upperite, right, the Russian apparatchik. The oligarchy is the business community which grovels to the authorities, who can close down any business at any moment, since business here is inseparable from theft. And the upper rat consists of the authorities who feed on the kickbacks from business. The way it works is that the former allow the latter to steal because the latter allow the former to feed. And one of the things we must remember is that, you know, I think in South Africa we always tend to think of corruption as some other group or some people who are purposely impossibly alien, right? Whether it's this man at the bottom or Julius Malema at the top, you know, we tend to think it's the other person, right? The person who's strangers, the politician, the professor. But often, you know, corruption comes from the people closest to us or from ourselves, right? And I think irony is a response to that. I thought I'd end with just two quotations which show you how close criticism and literature come in 20th and 21st century Russia. You can more or less tell where they're from. One is from Pilev and one is from Shklovsky. Right? Shklovsky says, the bottom, we are the stones on which truth is sharpened, which I think is a very beautiful view of human life. And Pelevin, or Ahuli, the werefox, tells us that life doesn't change much from one culture to another, but the human soul requires a beautiful wrapper. Russian culture, though, fails to provide one, and it calls the state of affairs spirituality. That's the reason for all the disasters. Thank you. I'll take some time. I can take some questions, but I'm just going to put my dog.